Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on January 1st of 2023 under the headline, Land Fraud Swindlers Plundered Oregon Badly. It's part one of a two-part sequence on this story. Here we go. On the morning of December 7th, 1904, Stephen A. D. Pewter had just arrived at the office of U.S. Marshal Jack Matthews. He was expecting some friends to come by and bail him out of jail. Pewter had just been convicted of masterminding a plan to swindle the U.S. government out of thousands of acres of prime timberlands. He had not yet been sentenced. Like all convicts, he had the option of either staying in jail until sentencing or posting bail, and in his case the bail was set at $4,000. He figured his friends, or rather unindicted co-conspirators, would be by shortly to help him raise the funds. No one came. It was starting to dawn on Pewter that no one was going to come. To be sure, he called his brother and asked him to pay a few social calls on his friends and business associates. The brother, as Pewter may have expected, soon reported back. None of the old cronies wanted to have anything to do with him anymore. Over the next few days, after he'd come up with his bail by borrowing it from family members, Pewter learned more details about why they were all so reticent. There was, as he'd well known, a new investigator in town from Washington, D.C., sent by the new Theodore Roosevelt administration, and tasked with putting a stop to the rampant land fraud that had been going on for decades all across Oregon and the West. This new sheriff, Francis Haney, had started his campaign by going after Pewter, who was the most successful, prominent, and notorious of the crooked land agents. Now Pewter, the land fraud king as he later became known, had been convicted along with several of his associates from lower-level financial backers, and the land fraudsters who had not yet been caught in Haney's dragnet were very much hoping the government's thirst would be slaked by this high-profile win, and that Haney would move on and let them continue pillaging the public domain as before. In other words, he was to be sacrificed to appease the gods in Washington, D.C. He was to be thrown under the bus, branded a bad apple, socially disowned, in order to protect the bigger fish involved and enable them to keep the good times rolling. And how much bigger were those bigger fish? Well, several of them were out-of-state millionaires, two of them were members of the United States House of Representatives, and one was United States Senator John H. Mitchell, whose real name was John M. Hipple, but that's another story. Well, Pewter was good and angry about this situation by the time he made it out of jail, and he was determined to give his old quote-unquote friends a good scare for their pains at the very least. But although he doesn't say specifically, it looks as if Pewter didn't actually decide to go into full-on vengeance mode until Mitchell started regularly using him as a whipping boy in press conferences about the land frauds. This was stupendously galling to Pewter because at one point, a few years earlier, he had actually paid Mitchell a $2,000 bribe to lean on the Lands Department to approve some fraudulent applications.
"Had Senator Mitchell held his peace, his name should never have been mentioned by me," Pewter raged to a former business partner afterwards. "But since he has seen fit to denounce me publicly through the columns of the daily press, discountenancing me in most scathing terms, I see no reason why I should protect him further."
The business that Pewter had made his career in was one that had been going on in Oregon since the very dawn of statehood. By the time Roosevelt's administration decided to put a stop to it, the wealthy and well-connected had been stealing land from the state and federal governments for four solid decades. Around the time the state was admitted to the Union, legally almost all of it belonged to the federal government. This it was busily handing out to homesteaders who could file claims on big chunks of it and prove it up by building cabins and raising crops and claim title to it for just a nominal filing fee. This system worked pretty well for parts of the state that were suitable for small farms, the Willamette Valley mostly, but it left big portions of the state out. Timberlands especially, as well as most of the drier portions of eastern Oregon, would not support a homesteader. So with an eye toward getting marginally farmable land and timberlands into productive use, the government created several new programs that were less rigorous. It also empowered the new state of Oregon to claim the state's swamplands to be reclaimed for agriculture. It was the Swamplands Grant that gave Oregon its first experience of wholesale land fraud. Maybe that was inevitable, since the whole idea of the grant was based on fantasy. The river bottomlands in the Mississippi Valley had included vast acreages of malarial swamps, which could be fairly easily reclaimed by building dikes and levees and draining them. But doing that was very expensive. The feds found it convenient to have the states take that on. They would take the swamp, reclaim it, and sell the resulting farmland to help the state pay its bills and put the land into productive use. Oregon had very little of that kind of swampland. But in 1870, the state legislature suddenly realized that if they redefined swamp to include bits of land that flooded once or twice in the spring, they could gin up a claim on vast amounts of the land in the state, which they could then hand over to their friends for super cheap. Here's how the swindle worked. A wealthy landowner, a sheep rancher, say, cultivated a state land agent and bribed or otherwise induced him to proclaim the banks and stream beds of every river, lake, or pond in the area he coveted as swampland. The owner could then pay 20 cents per acre to reserve the property. After successfully reclaiming it, he would then be allowed to buy it outright for an additional 80 cents an acre. So the landowner would take charge of the seasonally flooded swampland, wait 6 months for the dry season, proclaim it reclaimed, and purchase it. In the case of our sheep rancher, this worked doubly well because by snapping up all the land with water running on it, he left nothing behind but dry pasture. He could be pretty confident that no sodbusters were going to be able to successfully claim any of it under the Homestead Act, and he'd get to graze all his sheep on it for free. But, you might object, with the state claiming huge swaths of swampland that wasn't really swampland, almost sight unseen, wasn't there a risk that the state would claim land that someone else had already claimed and owned? Yes, and that happened a lot. In fact, it was one of the preferred outcomes for the scammers because after the state had sold, quote-unquote, you someone else's land, it would have to give you another piece of state property in lieu of the one you'd contracted for. And you got to pick which piece of lieu land, as they called it, you got. We'll be talking about some of the other creative ways crooks like Pewter figured out how to swindle the state and the national government out of valuable land in part two of this story, coming out on the podcast feed tomorrow morning. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible through our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.